He's one of rock and roll's most iconic figures. He wrote and sang Beth, the chart-topping and award-winning song that would set the standard for rock ballads.
Beth, I hear you calling, but I can't come home right now. Me and the boys are playing, and we just can't find the sound. Just a few more hours, and I'll be right home to you. I think I hear them calling. Oh, Beth, what can I do? Beth, what can I do?
His drumming style has inspired musicians around the world. In his new memoir, Makeup to Breakup, My Life in and Out of Kiss, Peter Criss offers an absorbing, eye-opening, and frank account of the incredible life that he has led. Kiss formed in 1973 and soon emerged as one of rock's most electrifying acts. Famed for their elaborate makeup, stage theatrics, and the Kiss Army, as the founding drummer, Peter Criss had an elevated perch on his sparks-emitting drum riser in stadiums around the world and a unique vantage point to the Kiss phenomenon. He has come a long way from the homemade drum set he pounded on nonstop as a kid growing up in Brooklyn in the 50s. He endured lean years, street violence, and the roller coaster of the 60s music scene, but he always knew that he'd make it, and he did. Again, the name of the book is Makeup to Breakup. It's a great pleasure to welcome Peter Criss to the roundtable. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's very cool. It's an honor. Thank you, Joe.
You look at this book and your life, and well, I don't think I'm giving too much away of saying the reader by the end of it says, "Well, good God, how did you survive all that?"
With God, I'm a major Roman Catholic kid. I went to Catholic school. I indicate in my book, even though it was rough. But God's never left my side, and I truly believe that till today. I still drop by church once a week. When I had my cancer scare, I was there every day for 7 days a week. But I never lost my faith. I think the world, I don't move without my faith. It's been with me from day one. I'm like a child. I have an undying love for Jesus, and I think through it all, as we say, all my lives, I don't know how many cat lives I've lived, quite a few I've lost, but he's always been there for me, and I've always sort of prayed to Mary, who's his mom, and I had a very unique way of doing it. I figure you can't say no to mom, so I always had this thing of praying to her, and I kid you not, I've had quite a few miracles in my life by this faith, I feel, for God, and it's not let me down till today.
It's fascinating because it comes up in the strangest places. You'll be in the middle of, well, quite frankly, an orgy, mm-hmm. and prayer would be a part of that scene at that moment.
Well, that's why I say it's a very unique way of kind of making a bargain with God, that I know I'm doing the wrong thing, and I know this isn't cool. But I sort of can't help myself because I am in my 20s and I'm in a rock and roll band, and I sort of figured this is what it was all about. So I always knew it was, I don't know if it was wrong. I was young, I was having a great time, but I still never lost my religion. I'm not like any other guy, different, you know. We had a great roller coaster ride, but when you're at that age and you have that many girls, my Lord, it's kind of hard to say no.
You talk about the success in the book, and at one point compare it to a glimpse of Beatlemania. When you're getting off that plane with the Kiss logo on it, and you've landed in Japan, and there's just thousands and thousands and thousands of people that are screaming at you as you get off the plane in full makeup, that has to fundamentally change you at some point.
Well, I got a feel, or I thought, this is what they must have felt like when they, because I'm a huge Beatles fan, and I realized when they came here, it was so huge when they came the first time. I'll never forget it. And I sort of felt, if this is what they felt when we got there, because we were chased literally like a Hard Day's Night through a couple of cars to get to another car. They were all over the car. They suffocated the car. It couldn't move. It reminded me of the movie. I was like living in the movie for a moment, and it was really cool. It was an amazing feeling of, oh my God, I don't believe, almost surreal that this isn't happening. I almost feel like I was in the Beatle movie, and this is kind of what they were going through when they were starting out. It was amazing. I didn't have any ego. I don't have an ego. I believe we're all the same. But I did feel a feeling of, I guess we kind of made it. This looks like we made it, because this is unbelievable.
When you look back at the early days and growing up in Brooklyn that you write about in the book, at what point in your life did you even think that music could be your life, could be your career?
Pretty much at an early, early age. My whole family loved music. My mother was a big influence on me. She sang like a bird. There was always music playing in the house. My dad was a big ballroom guy, so there was always big band music playing. And I loved it the minute I heard it, from 5 years old up. And pretty much, by 13, that's what I wanted to do. I mean, I was through the gangs and all that stuff. And in those days, either you join a gang or you're beat up by every other gang. So at least if you get in a gang, you got some protection. And I was not a bad kid, but I had my runnings around, and it was almost like kind of living in the jungle. You kind of either go with it or you're going to live in your house all day, and I wasn't sure going to do that.
You write in the book about how jazz was such a part of your early life.
Hugely, and it still is. When my dad put on Sing, 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 I knew immediately it was like being hit by a bolt of lightning. That's what I want to do. Holy mackerel, that's what I want to be. I want to be whoever that is on that record. I want to do what he's doing. I want to be the man. I want to be Gene Krupa. That's what I want to do in my life. And through it all, it was such a 60s and 70s, you couldn't ask for a better time to be a musician. I told my wife, I was born at a perfect time for rock and roll for musicians. It was a time we had Beethoven, Brahms, and Mozart, and all the greats, and it seemed that they were all around that same period of history. I'm a major history guy, and I paid attention to that, and I said, Jesus, you had all these great poses all around pretty much the same era. Same thing I felt with the 60s, 70s. You had the doo-wop music going into basically rockabilly, and then Elvis kind of comes along, and then before you know it, there's a great Motown. And I'm a huge Motown guy. I loved it. But jazz, when I heard the big bands, I got addicted to big bands. I was into Artie Shore and Benny Goodman and just all that Harry James, all that great big band stuff, big Sinatra fan. But it led eventually where I became very good friends with Jerry Nolan, who was my best friend, who was a drummer of the New York Dolls. He had the same ambition as me. We were kids together. We grew up together. We both wanted to make it. And our influences were pretty similar. And as they left the big band kind of stuff, we started getting very deeper into Dave Brubeck and Miles Davis and Charlie Parker and Mingus. That whole style of jazz that was very different than swing. But it was interesting for us as drummers because of the time changes Joe Morello would do or the music would do. And I loved Latin jazz. I loved Herbie Mann. So my broadening of music is very broad. I believe that all music should be listened to as a musician. You cannot be just on one music playing three chords and that's what you're good at. I can't call a guy a musician that. You should be able to play from a polka to a samba to a rock and roll song to a jazz song. Now, if you could do this to me, you're a good musician. And I wanted to be a really good musician. That's what really meant a lot to me more than anything, was that I could really conquer my craft. And pretty much if I got hired, I could get hired in any realm that I could play. But jazz always leaned very heavily. And even in the Kiss days, all through it, you'll hear through my drumming, jazz fills, jazz stuff. It's always a jazz thing here. It would be usually a rock and roll fill. I would throw some sort of jazz stuff. I think that had a lot to do with our sound. Today, I still hear drummers. I just recently got a Legendary Drum Award for influencing drummers. And a lot of them heard that, felt that you could hear my big jazz overtones in my rock and roll playing. Mm. So I love it. I love the stuff. I'm actually thinking of putting a little jazz band together and going out playing.
That'd be fun. You talk about it in the book, and I mentioned it in the introduction, of having that homemade drum set, and you talk about these musical influences. Early in the book, you bring us to 1970, and you say, seeing Elton John was an epiphany for you. He played your song, and I started crying. He was just so good.
Yes, it's true. I went to England on part of my honeymoon with my first wife, and we went to a great club called the Speakeasy then, it was called. Somebody told us to go there. That's where all the great music is. And we went, and I sat there, and here comes this guy up there with a trio, and it's Elton John before he made it. And he goes to his set, and in the set was my song. And I never heard anything so beautiful in my life. And every other song was just as good and just as good and just as good. And, yeah, I had tears in my eyes. I couldn't believe this guy was that great, you know, in a club. And I said to my wife then, this guy is going to be huge someday. And then a year later, whatever it was, I get, you know, his record breaks, my song breaks. It's huge. It's a gigantic smash. And the rest for Elton is history. Jesus, forget about it. He is one of the great iconic guys of our time, great songwriters of our time. And so I wasn't that off. I was pretty good at judging talent. I should have been on American Idol.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, I'm a pretty good judge because here's a guy who was in a bar at that time, and now he's the biggest iconic songwriter in the world. So he gave me, like, wait a minute, I got to go home. I got to do original music. That's the only way you can make it. You can't keep doing cover songs and playing nightclubs doing that. You've got to really buckle down and search and try to come up or join a band that does nothing but original music, because that is going to be the only avenue to the top.
So you put an ad, a classified ad, in Rolling Stone magazine with 12 simple words. You say, experienced rock and roll drummer looking for original group doing soft and hard music. And then you get a call from Gene Simmons.
One of the most interesting calls I've gotten in my life. And that's what sort of made me interested in Mr. Simmons and Mr. Stanley. It's like I felt his questioning was like an FBI agent, for Christ's sake. They couldn't ask what size shoes I had, what was my waist, what was my hair long. It just was like I was being patted down. And I liked it, though, because he was really ambitious, and he had a lot of enthusiasm in his voice. And I could hear the hunger that I had, and I was very impressed by that. He sounded very smart. He sounded like he knew where he was going and what he wanted, and that's exactly where I was at in my life. And so, you know, the rest we met, and of course it's all in the book of how that went. But it was, again, the most probably one of the best phone calls I got in my life.
Given, as you stated early on, that there was certainly a roller coaster aspect to all of this, looking in retrospect, those early formative years of the group, you seem to click very quickly.
Yes, and that's it. And of course, we made it very quickly in retrospect,
right,
of rock and roll. Exactly right. You know, no band usually makes it a couple of years together. But, yeah, when Ace came along, he had the same attitude. He was a lot lazier, but he definitely had the originality of a guitarist that we've never heard before, and he played like no other we ever heard. We definitely did believe he was from another planet. We'd never seen anything like this guy. This guy was truly an original character, and so were we. We were truly your guys, you know, way out there, and it, some insane reason, the four of us one night, you know, we were messing around, and the sound came. We definitely all knew we have a sound. There's a sound here, and we need to now get people to hear us and hear this sound that we came upon. And then the makeup, of course, starts, you know, comes into play, and we all start working on that constantly, and we all agreed on that we loved, since we're all New York guys, we loved Broadway, we loved theatric. We thought, what about a rock show with a real rock and roll show, a real event, more than just songs and guys in jeans and T-shirts. I mean, a real something that you'll never forget the rest of your life. So none of us were appalled to doing anything, whatever it was. Sure, go ahead, man. You want to paint your feet red and shave your head? Well, let's see what that looks like.
Hmm.
So that open mind then we had at that, in the beginning, that was there, that got lost along the road, was dynamite. I was so impressed also with that attitude, that someone was willing to do anything, actually anything, to make it, and that's what it takes to make it, I believe.
You said early on that you didn't have an ego, but my goodness, there is a lot of ego in that group that you contended with, that seemed to develop very early in your success. And I'm curious as to how much of being a character and putting on the makeup enabled you to put up with that, because there was what was on stage and there what was off stage.
Well, we all had big egos. I never thought of myself ever as the greatest drummer on the planet. I never thought of that. But ego, as far as respect of what we were and who we were, absolutely, we all had the same. Some more than others. And I didn't even, as I'm older and I do see a lot and I think a lot more of my clarity, even then when I met Gene and Paul, they finished an album for some company. Something went wrong. But they actually got rid of every member they did the album with. And now they were running the show. It was their thing. And I didn't see that then, the Machiavellian power tripping that was there already, that was right there at the door before I even opened it and walked in. I didn't pay attention to that. And that developed immensely. That got worse. More money, more arenas, bigger stadiums, more women, bigger, more power tripping became the issue in the band. And it became so... I couldn't deal with it anymore, really. For me, we were really brothers in arms. We were all for one, one for all. And as in any band or marriage, it just, as time was going on, and we got too much too soon, I think. For me, making it, sometimes I think coming from a poor neighborhood and a poor family, it was too much for me to handle. I didn't understand fame. One minute I was living in four rooms with seven people, and then one day I have a 22-room mansion. And I could get anything I want at any time I wanted. That's a very scary place to be, trust me. It's a lot of power. You could abuse it, or you could use it the correct way. I abused it in many ways because drugs was a big thing back then, and everybody was doing them, and I had no idea of the backlash of it until I found myself in trouble. And I admit it in the book. I'm as tough on me in this book as I am on anybody else. I don't give myself any slack or leeway that I didn't give anybody else. I grew up not to lie. I'm a very honest, straight shooter. Most of my fans were waiting for this because of my honesty. And I felt, after a while, I couldn't deal with all the insanity. It just got to be too much one-way streets, and if you don't walk that street, I'll mentally batter you. I'll play these mind games. I'm a 5 years cancer-free guy. My wife had cancer. Now I look at life every day as such a gift. I have no time anymore to hold grudges of what went on 50 years ago or 25 years ago. I'm a different man today. My whole outlook of life is, I just got a major award as an ambassador for men's breast cancer. I'm so honored by that. I put that above all my gold and platinum albums, because all those accolades mean nothing as to saving a life. My whole world has changed with a lot of outlook. But in the book, I'm angry at a lot of times because I'm still working on that. I'm trying to let go of that because I was deeply hurt. I still feel I'm a casualty of the rock and roll wars. There's some things I'm still having trouble with, my demons and forgiving things that went on, but I'm working on it.
How did you get left out? In the sense of this brotherhood, all for one and one for all, and suddenly it becomes two guys against you.
Well, I wasn't then... Back then, somewhat in my right mind, I call it my crazy years. These was crazier. And so I wasn't paying attention. Really, I was enjoying the ride, the money, the women, the cars, the clothes. And I always believed in music is an attitude. There is no science to music. Rock and roll, especially, is a total attitude. Look at my favorite band, the Rolling Stones. It's a major attitude. It has nothing to do with who's singing in pitch or who's playing, you know, it to me it's a major, and it always has been. That's why it goes back to hating Elvis, because the parents didn't want to see him shake. It's always been that kind of rebellious attitude, and I had that from a kid, as you read my gang days and my rebellious ways. So that's changed a lot,
right,
with age.
Well, so when you look at
they started. I get, you know, where jeans started taking over the merchandising stuff constantly. And I really didn't care, because I didn't care about a Barbie doll. I didn't care about lunchboxes. I didn't care about sleepy bags. To me, we were a band, not a brand. We were four guys that dyed their hair blue black in a bathtub in the Village with a great guy, Sean Delaney, and wanted the same thing. I didn't care about selling toys. I wanted to be a musician and still feel that strong about my. It was always the music for me. Had nothing to do with all that. And he went berserk with that stuff. And then, of course, Mr. Stanley was totally insane because of the ego he has, that he always has to be center stage, kind of, you know, all the time. So these guys actually even started battling each other for supremacies of who gets the top word. And Ace and I were more, and I don't want to throw myself in the boat with him because I don't feel the same with it as Ace does, but we sort of looked at it more again as it was a rock and roll band. It was loose. We wanted to keep it loose. I didn't really pay attention to the business kind of stuff. It wasn't my forte. It never has been. I'm all about feeling, and I wear my heart on my sleeve.
So even when you would come back for a reunion tour, thinking that you have a deal that is good and set, you find out that it's not.
No. And I knew that. And it was funny because, as I say, right from the beginning, they wanted to give Ace more. The first meeting, we sat down and talked after the Unplugged show. And I got up and was ready to walk out and said, "You got to be kidding me. Like, you're going to give this guy more than me?" And I was the third member of the band, and I started the band, and I'm now supposed to be the lowest denominator. And I wrote Beth, which won a People's Choice, and broke all records. Destroyer was falling off the charts, and I saved it. I mean, now I'm going to be getting a 10% of gazillions of dollars. You're going to make you crazy. And immediately I could see it was all about the good old M-O-N-E-Y again. But at that point, between you and me, my life was a disaster. I went through a divorce. I lost my mother of cancer. I owed the IRS $3 million from back in the 70s. We invested in coal through the years. It built up to that. I was really a wreck. I was living in an apartment that got wound up leveled, and I got carjacked. A guy broke my face, and I still have 6 screws holding up my cheekbones. I wasn't going to pass this up. I just turned 50. I said to myself, I have nothing but, you know, I have $100,000 in my name. I was worth $20 million. Now, this chance, this is a second chance. I prayed hard for this. I went to church left and right to pray for a second chance again in life. And I said, if I got it, I wouldn't blow it. I wasn't doing drugs at that point. I don't do drugs anymore. I haven't done them since 84. And I said, you know, I'm going to really grab this chance and go with it and do everything I got to do, and maybe it'll all be good, and maybe we'll make up for what didn't happen back when we broke up, because we broke up so cruddy. We'll make up for all that. The fans will really get us bigger and better. It'll all be good. So I went into it with great, great intentions. They went into it with nothing but the money.
There was a point, January 17th, 1994, you have a .357 Magnum halfway down your throat. I mean, things were as bad as it gets. And it was ultimately your family and your kids and thinking of them that brought you around.
Yes.
But I can only assume it was not the first time that you thought that leaving this planet was easier than staying on it.
No, it was. Actually, it was the real deal. This time, that's why I stopped the book off with it. It's at my lowest of low points in my life. I really was at this where I was sitting in the rubble of after the earthquake in my home, in this little apartment I had in Hollywood, no less. I'm living from where I was living in Palos Verdes, in a beautiful home, and everything was busted. My clothes, the toilets were broken. There was water and stuff from the plants everywhere. It looked like Vietnam. And I just thought, man, is this it? You know, all this work from coming from nothing to something to nothing. Is this it? Where's my family? My wife left me for my lawyer. My daughter's not here, who I love immensely. I just thought, you know what? Maybe the world would be better off without me, and maybe I'd be better off without this pain that I'm having. And I don't remember if it was after I got carjacked. I think it was. It might have been either after or right before that. So I don't really have a clear mind of that, because that was so devastating. But I was pretty much at the end of my rope, and when I tasted that taste and I looked over, and there was the only thing standing in my apartment was a picture of my daughter on a dresser, and there was a light shining on it, I just said, forget about this. This is not the way I'm going to check out, like every other rock star in the world, suicide. You know, and I thought of my mother. How disrespectful is this? I thought of my family, and being a Catholic, I sure wasn't going to go to hell. And we believe suicide is a definite straight trip down there. And all that came, some sort of clarity out. I believe it came from God to stop me.
Obviously, you are going through what you're going through, and there is a public out there that loves this band, loved the band, and of course want to hear a happy ending, in the sense that someday it will all be behind you, and you'll be able to reunite, maybe not even as a band, but at least as a group of four guys who got together very early in their lives. Mm-hmm. Reading this book, it doesn't seem like that is likely. But
no, and it's not the way it was supposed to go between you and me. Every man, you know, you write, you're lucky to ever write a book about your life.
Right.
And I, way back in the day, it's funny, I met my business manager, came to my signing yesterday. I haven't seen him in eons. He's godfather to my daughter. And he remembers me telling him when I was in my 20s, someday I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be a grand book, and it's going to be the greatest story ever about the greatest band. And it's going to, and you know, so I had always a notion of writing the most cheerful, loving autobiography a guy could put together. I didn't ask for all the tragedies. I didn't expect them. You could read Aerosmith's books. You could read a lot of other bands. Same grief, same nonsense, same insanity. I may be a little more honest about it. But, you know, I would have loved to have a grand, you know, whoop, you know, we would just die for each other, and we're still the most greatest friends. But between you and me, pal, let me tell you, when I had my cancer, not one of them called me to say, how you doing, Peter? How you feeling? I got one call, and that was from Bill Acoin, my old manager, who I haven't heard from in a long, long time. And the phone rang, and he said, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud to see you step out and say this. I love you so much. You're such a man to do this. You should go out more often. You'd be amazed how many people love you. And I just wanted to call and tell you that I am so proud of you. And he died a few weeks later. It was devastating to me. I did not get any other calls. Now, between you and me and the man in the moon, I would have called them, because it still has to do with human feelings, nothing to do with the hatred. I didn't realize they had that much for me as I may have for them. But I sure am a human, and I'm a Christian, and I would have called. And by not calling it, really, to be honest, really hurt me a lot. I was really kind of, you know, just hurt me. And then I realized, well, maybe, Peter, you're not that off the beat about these gentlemen. You know, it seems if you don't even, you know, you have cancer and you don't even get a, you know, I hope you're doing okay. What right. else do you expect?
You write in one point of the book when you left, I never thought of the guys. I never missed the makeup. I never missed the touring. I felt like I had escaped from some prison. And that escape from that prison, I mean, there's that point where, you know, there's a picture of you in the book of leading a breast cancer walk and cutting the rope. And there's a joy on your face at that moment that I don't think is rivaled at any point in the story.
You're so right. Yes. And that's why I say my life has changed. This year we walked 20,000 people. Last year, 17,000. Again, I just got an amazing award as a diplomat in men's breast cancer. I'm told already I'm making a change. I walked this year and said men, too, get breast cancer. It's a whole new calling for me, a major different auditorium in my life. But I really feel it's enlightened me. It my wife and I survived it. We both major Christians. We believe God had a lot to do with that. The Peter Chris of today has a lot more important things to do than wallow on my past. I figured this book was the end of it. This is what went on. This is where I am today. I'm a really happy camper. We just bought new property overlooking the water. We're finally getting our little dream house. I adopted a cat from a kennel that was couldn't be put down. We've saved her life. I don't know. I've become a lot more of a mellower guy. I see now I want to kind of after this year I'm done with the KISS kind of stuff. I'm working actually on a children's book. I'm working on a screenplay, a comedy, and I have some new music I've recorded. So I'm sort of doing things now at my own pace, and I'm enjoying my wife and my life and my sisters and my granddaughter. I have a granddaughter of 5. I'm living a pretty normal life, and I like it. And well, yeah, I'm glad you could see that in that picture, because I was so proud.
Well, you look at it. The name of the book is Makeup to Break Up. Peter Chris is the author. Peter, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you.
I really enjoyed talking to you. Best of luck to you in all the future work and with the book as well.
Thank you so much, and I'm honored. And God bless you, and have a great holiday. And remember, men get breast cancer.
Peter, thank you very much for sharing with us.
God bless you, man. Take care.
Thank you.
Me and the boys will be playing all night.
Again, the name of the book is Makeup to Break Up My Life In and Out of KISS. It is published by Scribner. Peter Chris is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.